Okay, next on the schedule is Parviz Ghavamian, who's going to be speaking about rings of metal-rich ejecta in Pappus A.
Excellent. thank you all for the opportunity to tell you about some of this work that we've done over here. And I did a lot of this during my part of my time as a sabbatical down in Australia with Ivo and other collaborators down there, including Mike at the time, right up to the very end. And so I wanted to give a acknowledgement here to not only Mike's incredible contribution to the science of nebular astrophysics through his models and his research, but also his vision in developing this wide field integral spectrograph that was being used down in Australia, the 2.3 meters. So he's contributed in many ways. So the data I'm talking about today actually come from the instrument that he designed. Now, what I wanted to reacquaint everyone with is the Renmin Pappus A, and this, to put into perspective where it's located, it's actually in a very busy area of the sky. And here is a very large wide field, you know, amateur photograph, O3 and H alpha, corresponding colors there, of the Vela supernova remnant. So, and this bar here is 3 degrees in the sky, so huge. And it's only about 250 parsecs away. So it's not surprising that looking through this enormous remnant, chances are you're going to see another remnant even farther away. And right, sure enough, right near the edge over here, if you blow that up and then look at it compared to the ROSAT X-ray image, you see that there's another supernova remnant seen in projection along Vela, and this is Pappus A. And you notice that that Pappus is bluer in this image. This is ROSAT HRI, so the bluer is the harder X-ray emission because it's younger. And here's Vela over here superimposed in front of that. And so this Pappus A is about 10 times farther away than Vela, and so that gives us like some comparison there. Now, Pappus A is a middle-aged supernova remnant, so here's this fantastic image that was presented by Katsuda et al. In 2010 from a mosaic of XMM and Chandra data, and so here's a few important facts about it. Here, the red is going to be the softer X-ray emission, including oxygen, K-alpha, and neon K-alpha, et cetera, are in green, and then the harder stuff is going to be in blue. And the age of Pappus A, based on the optical proper motion work that Frank Winkler's done, is somewhere on around 3,700 years is what he got. And other analyses in the X-rays, for example, with the neutron star recoil, et cetera, give values up near 4,400. So somewhere in that range is the age of the supernova remnant. Now, there's a strong interaction of the remnant on this side, this is the northeastern side, with clouds, including H1 and CO, and there's been a lot of work done on this over the years. So there's a very strong brightening that occurs on this side, a circumstellar interaction. And the radius of this remnant, if you assume a distance of 2.2 kiloparsecs, which is about the value that most people use, the radius here is 25 arc minutes, which projects to 16 parsecs. So this thing is quite large, Cygnus loop sort of size large. Within the supernova remnant, just in the last few years, there have been detections of silicon-rich and oxygen-neon-magnesium-rich ejecta. And this is all relatively new stuff. And these arrows here point to some material that was discovered by Katsuda et al. Just over the last like few years that is metal rich. So this is clearly one of those oxygen rich remnants. And the optical emission that's seen from the oxygen emission also confirms this, that there's dense clumps of ejecta out there that are interacting with the blast wave. And the progenitor mass, based on abundance ratio, somewhere around 25, I'm presuming plus or minus a few solar masses, of material. And there's a neutron star in here, it's a quiescent one, a CCO, that's leaving the scene of the explosion with a high proper motion. The value I have over here actually has been corrected. This is a 2007 value. The more current one is down near 675 kilometers per second in the plane of the sky. So if you were to look up close to this, and here's some of the CTIO imagery that Frank did over the last few years, H-alpha and O3 showing up like this. It's kind of hard to tell where Pappus A is located over here, but some of the material that you see over here in the foreground are all unrelated to the remnant itself. But somewhere down here near the middle, there's this large structure over here of oxygen-rich ejecta showing up in O3 with a little bit of H-alpha associated with it. And these are O-rich radiative shocks a lot of the work that Frank did in 85 with others and in 88. And what's interesting is over here off on the side in this imagery, there are shocks here where Mike himself did work back in 77 where they took spectra of these and they found that nitrogen 265-83 to H-alpha was elevated. It was around 4 or so, and this was indicating enrichment in the material here. And this, so I should say RSG, not RGB, possibly red relic material from the red supergiant phase. So if you zoom in on the area near the middle, here is the oxygen-rich ejecta moving, and these are proper motion vectors. These were taken from Frank's 88 paper showing about 2/10 of an arc second per year material moving in this direction. And the center of expansion of the remnant is within this ellipse over here as determined by them. But then down here, there's a structure that they nicknamed the swirl back in 1989. And this over here is showing H-alpha and nitrogen 2. You can't tell them apart because this is a narrow band image. It takes them both in. But there's a ring of material with a spray of material pointing away from it, clumps that are being shredded and torn away from it here. And within it, there are these concentric rings that seem to vary in composition, including some places dominated by sulfur, some places dominated by oxygen. And there's this continuous sort of corkscrewing-like effect that you see over here. And if you were to go in and fit these projected sizes on the sky, you get values around an arc minute or so with a little bit of squashed shape because of the projection, most likely. But at the distance of 2.2 kiloparsecs, these values are a good chunk of a parsec in size. So these rings are not tiny things. They're rather large structures. The neutron star is located down at this end here, and it's moving away from the scene of the explosion, just like in all the talks we had before where the ejecta and the neutron star go in opposite directions. These are going in opposite directions. And this swirl over here is located kind of somewhere in the middle. And one of the things I'm going to show you is that this material here is all entirely blue-shifted material, so it's all actually heading toward us. So one of the things that we wanted to do with the WIFE's integral field spectrograph was to try and understand the structure of this and the composition of this swirl. And so over a period of a couple of years over here, we went in and the WIFE's field of view is here, 24 by 36 arc seconds for one frame, and did this mosaic as best we could. There were some technical issues during the observations that made the shifts a little bit different than they should be, but we made this mosaic of around 29 fields, about an hour per field, and this simultaneously takes spectra in the blue and in the red with a resolution of around 3,000. Spectral coverage, very nice spectral coverage, 100 kilometer per second resolution. So this gets down to a very low surface brightness limit in the observations, and so we were able to pick out a lot of really faint features in this. And so if you were to now take this, I'm going to take this ring over here, and I'm going to show it kind of flipped because this is the way it looks in the integral field data. It is flipped this way. We're able to go in and by taking spectra at each one of the spaxels, an arc second bar an arc second in size, each spaxel, each of these boxes is about 3 arc seconds by 3. If you can actually cover most of the structure of the rings over here and extract spectra from them. And so there were around 1,000 spectra that we were able to extract automatically and to fit their line profiles. And so here's a movie that shows, loaded into QFIT's view, here are all the fields like this, and this little green area here shows what a spectrum looks like from this one little patch here. And as I step through the movie, you're going to see this emission here. This is an example of nitrogen 2-6548 that's been blue shifted to 1,350 kilometers per second. And as this gray area, as it sweeps over that, you will then pick up H-alpha that is similarly blue shifted, but also some blue shifted nitrogen 2 at a lower speed. And so you'll see these various contributions as this thing runs. So as this steps through, you can see the sky varying as it goes through. And then right when it comes to the fastest ring, you're going to see this ring appear, and then this other structure appear as it steps through. And that's 6583 from the ejecta. That's the sky. And this over here is sky nitrogen 2, and then it disappears. And as this then continues along, eventually you hit sulfur 2. So you notice there's two lines here, the doublet from the sky, and then these two fat doublets that two lines that come from the ejecta. And so now it's going to sweep on the ejecta over here you again see similar ring, but then the other material shows up more strongly in sulfur too. So this gives you some sense of how you can step through in wavelength. Now what's confusing about this is that just because you extract an image at one wavelength does not mean that you're seeing all material only at that one velocity. It turns out there are different lines that are redshifted or blueshifted to different velocities, and so you can get different things in your field of view. You need to actually extract the spectra at each point and then try to map it on the sky what it looks like. And so what we did was, here's an example of the ring that we, the high velocity ring that we had. We actually had to do careful sky subtraction in order to isolate what the wavelengths and Doppler shifts of all these were. So here's the outer part of the swirl at in 6548, radial velocity of 1350. And so here's a spectrum. See, this little box over here shows a spectrum of what this looks like without any sky subtraction. So you see very strong nitrogen 2, and you see night sky nitrogen 2, and then you see H alpha down here as well. And so what you find is that there is a lot of blending. So when you remove the sky contribution, you're able to finally pick out what is genuinely ejecta. So you can tell over here already that nitrogen 2 is very much stronger than H alpha, and the ratio is on the order of 10 to 11 in many of the spectra we have from the ring. And these, based on our shock models, radiative shock models that try to fit this, our nominal results were values over 100 times solar. So this is material that's supernova ejecta. It's not red giant wind, it's actual ejecta. Here's another example of the ring showing sulfur 2 over here. And here's a case where the confusion is that you have your sulfur 2, you have your two doublets, from the ejecta and the one from the sky, and they're shifted so that the 6731 from the ejecta lands on top of 6716 from the sky. And so you end up with three lines instead of four. So it's almost like someone diabolically calculated this just to, you know, make it confusing. So if you try to do a careful sky subtraction, you then end up with a doublet coming just from the ejecta ring. And you see the ratio here is close to just a little bit more than 1.1 to 1. Nominally results around a few hundred to 1,000 particles per cubic centimeter in those sulfur-rich shocks. So if you go in and look at all the spectra, extract them and fit them, here's what you see. This is a color map that shows nitrogen 2, 6548, shown across the remnant. And what you see here is this is that large ring structure in the outer part in nitrogen 2. And the widths of these little points over here indicate how wide the emission lines are that were fit. And the really largest widths over here are around a few hundred kilometers per second, and many of them are 150 to 200 or so. But this ring, by the way, doesn't lie behind the red thing. This is just the way the color map worked out. But this ring over here has Doppler shifts near 1350, and then you see that it gives way to another one right around 920, like that, and you notice that there isn't a lot of color in between, not a whole lot, and so you actually have maybe this little transition region here, but there tend to be discrete velocities where you see this material. The sulfur 2 emission, there's a little bit coming from the outer ring, but most of it seems to be concentrated on the next ring in at these two velocities over here, and then you go into the next one, and here's O3, and that is concentrated in a slightly more spread out, diffuse area like this, but it also tends to land on very specific velocities, seems to go to even slower ones. So so there seems to be these very distinct radial velocities that, in which you find these rings as they expand, as they head toward us, and trying to interpret what this means is actually quite challenging. So why the rings are so unusual, their velocities, they seem to somehow be kind of quantized. Are they even associated with Puppis A? Well, the velocities and the central location of Puppis A suggest that yes. The swirl shows only blue-shifted emission, and so it's consistent. So this is where I sort of go away from just talking about data and resort to idle shooting from the hip speculation. This may be consistent with a binary explosion principle picture, where the binary, the secondary, was between us and the star that exploded, and that you're actually seeing shattering of the ejecta from the explosion against the secondary. The dynamical timescale of the knots, if you go in and try to figure out what those are, the value I got was somewhere on around 100 to 150 years. So what we're seeing in these spray of material leaving the rings is that these have only been recently shocked. These were not shocked 3,000 years ago. They were shocked recently. And these seem similar in abundances and behavior to the FMFs, as Rob has named them, the FIMFs, fast-moving flocculi in CAS A, although they seem to be slower than the main body of the ejecta. So here's even more speculation. Here's a paper by Hirai et al, where they did a simulation of a binary system, and as Nathan Smith pointed out, almost 70% or more of high mass stars are considered to be in binary or in multiple star systems. And so this simulation shows a 10 solar mass, two 10 solar mass stars, a few tens of solar radii away from one another. And when one explodes and hits the other one, it produces this shattering of ejecta. And here are the velocity patterns. And as the material travels around it, so here's my picture. Here's your two stars. And then you have an explosion like this where material sweeps around this binary star here, this companion, and leaves this area over here that's sort of devoid of ejecta like that. But because this material is sweeping around this way, it's not, the arrow is shorter, it's not actually expanding as quickly as the other main body of the ejecta. So this material that's moving along this edge of the funnel is actually going slower than the material that is farther out over here. And so now if you go and you look at what the velocities are, the one we're measuring with WIFES is toward our line of sight where we're located here, and a tangential speed doesn't have to be the same as the one along us, so it could actually be considerably slower. So if you now go like a few thousand years later from the site of explosion as this material is coming out, then the reverse shock eventually comes in and starts heading down this funnel and producing shocks that shred material as it goes down. And this might, for example, explain how you can get, as it's going down, you get smaller and smaller rings of material deeper into the ejecta as it propagates down into the ejecta like that. And so this is just, again, me shooting from the hip, putting ideas out there since things like this have been talked about already. This conical ejecta pattern, it may produce slow lateral expansion. So since this material is heading toward you, it may expand rather slowly in the plane of the sky, but the ring pattern itself may actually be moving at a very different speed. And so so this may be why, for example, when Winkler et al. In 89 looked at a swirl, and they said maybe this comes from a second supernova within Puppis A, they had taken the radial velocities they had measured and they applied them to the rings and ran them back in time, and they said that this must have been a supernova that went off 800 years ago. Well, not necessarily. If the rings are not expanding at 1300, maybe they're expanding at considerably slower, you could actually get away with a much older age, and hence something that's consistent with the original Puppis A explosion. And if the outer ring is moving at 1,350 kilometers per second, you can actually figure out where this ring would be, how far away it would be from the explosion site right now. And the number that you get, assuming this range, is somewhere between 5 and 6 parsecs from the explosion center. And this is well inside Puppis A because the outer radius of Puppis A is at 16 parsecs. So this would be something that is deep down within the supernova remnant. Okay, so last few notes over here then. There's very weak emission associated with the rings and the O-rich ejecta, so it suggests a star that has lost most of its hydrogen mass before the explosion. And this is something that Roger concluded for Puppis A in 2005 with his model, possibly a type 2b. There are other explanations for the swirl. For example, maybe it's some sort of an ejecta pattern from the explosion itself. Another possibility is there a wind explanation? Well, that produces the problem where how do you get up to 1350 kilometers per second? And here are some of the other things that we found. We found other lines in the WIFES data, but proper motions and search for a surviving binary companion, if there is one, is something that we need to do as well. So that's the laundry list there, and I'll wrap it up there. Thank you.
Okay, time for one or two questions. Up in the front here.
If there was a binary companion to the star that exploded, then is it possible to use proper motion studies of the current nearby stars around this region and identify what the possible binary companion is?
I would think so. The star, the site of the explosion is 2,200 parsecs away, so with proper motion, you probably would need a pretty long baseline to do it. If the velocities are like hundreds of kilometers per second, you would need a pretty big baseline, but it's in principle doable.
Okay. Sure.
Thanks, very interesting, very nice conclusions. I have only one comment. The image that you showed It's not by Katsuda, it's Dobner, Jacani, Castelletti.
Oh, okay.
The combination of Chandra and XMM, we produce that. And in fact, in X-rays...
Thank you for correcting me. Thank you for correcting me.
We found several evidence of interaction with small blocks, small circles in X-rays that suggest that there are blocks in front that were, it's the shock front is interacting.
Oh, so that means toward the projected center
yes,
of the remnant.
Okay, yes, okay, there's so, a projected center.
Oh, it makes sense, too, when you look in the X-rays, you see all these, like, these bubbles and filaments and things. And, it seems
and
like
they are there.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, we're just there on time. Parviz, if anybody has more questions, please feel free to catch them in the coffee break, which we're now going to adjourn for. Please, again, thank you, Parviz.
Thank you.
Okay, back in 30 minutes.